Who are we? Where do we come from? Are there other humans in our Milky Way galaxy? What is our real history? What happens after we die? Or what created our universe? What is the purpose of our life? What evolutionary steps do human societies go through? Who built the ancient monolithic site found all over the Earth? How do the extraterrestrials travel from star to star system with almost no time passing? Ohio Exopolitics is on at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Revolution Radio. Join Mark Snyder as he interviews a myriad of excellent guests each Saturday night on Revolution Radio.
At freedomslips.com.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Our guest this evening is Ole Domegaard. His website is www.lightonconspiracies.com. Ole is a prize-winning author, investigator, a former journalist. For some 30 years, he has worked hard on exposing some of the biggest conspiracies around the globe, something that has turned out to be a very dangerous task. His goal is to prevent the global elite from turning this beautiful world into a controlled and horrible place. He is totally dedicated to revealing their agenda, including all the false flag operations all over the world. Ole, how are you this evening?
I'm super good, thank you. I'm very honored to be on your show.
And how was the weather in Spain today?
I tell you, it's pitch black. It's the middle of the night. The stars are looking beautiful, but otherwise than that, I have no idea.
And we were talking at the beginning, before the show started, a little bit about one of the greatest guitarists of all time, Paco de Lucía.
Yeah.
He died recently of a heart attack, one of the great Spanish flamenco guitarists.
Yeah, bless his gentle soul.
But you know, I guess there's probably no conspiracy there, correct?
I have absolutely no idea, but I have never heard of any conspiracies within the flamenco world or anything like that. It's the only places where people are taking out is when there's a massive amount of money or to get be earned. That's the only places I've seen these assassinations done.
Well, let's start out with Whitney Houston. Whitney Houston was found dead in the bathtub of her room at the Hilton Hotel in Beverly Hills on February 11th, 2012. And Ole, I'd like to ask you, do you think the death of Whitney Houston was an Illuminati ritual sacrifice?
I normally try to avoid that that whole thing because it gives... there's a lot of people that just shuts down if you start talking about these things instead of just being a plain, simple murder. But there's a lot of things pointing in that direction, I would say, yes.
And why would the global elite want Whitney Houston dead?
The global elite, I mean, this is... It comes to a point where with some artists where they are, according to themselves and what they've been informed by the elite or members of the elite, that they're worth more dead than alive. That when their career is going downwards and where there's a possibility to revive their whole name and career and everything by letting them die in some kind of brutal way, but covering it up as a suicide or an accident and so, and thus creating an enormous shock in the world of this tragedy and an enormous cry for more and more music so that they can sell more and more and more records and produce memorial films and all of these documentaries, everything to create an enormous sale of records and an enormous income for this group.
So Whitney was found dead in the bathtub of her hotel room. Do you know how long she had before she had to go on stage?
No, as far as I know, this was quite a strange day, if you want to say. She had been at the Beverly Hilton Hotel for a day or so together with her daughter Bobby Christine and some of her family members and friends, and it was the day she died was the day of the pre-Grammy party with some 800 guests down in the ballroom downstairs. And it's when you look at it, at first it looks like a possible suicide or a possible that she just drowned in a bathtub. I would just say it's not that easy to drown in a bathtub, but what they're trying to give the appearance of is that she was drunk or on pills or something like that and fell asleep under the influence of drugs and then slided down into the bathtub and drowned. But it's like when you start, if you look at it as a crime scene and you start looking at what was going on and see the evidence around it, that's when it starts looking very strange. And like you said, she died on February 12, 2012. She was 48 by now and had a career, and her voice was on the way down big time. And her manager, Clive Davis, had arranged for this pre-Grammy party. And what happened was that officially Whitney had been partying the last few days, especially with a new found friend of hers. And she went to a hotel room early afternoon. And the official story says that she entered the room at 2:30 in the afternoon, and then she was discovered dead in the bathtub around 3:30, an hour later. But when you see the statement of what the witnesses said and so on, was that she was already cold when they found her 1 hour later. And if you, well, you can figure it out yourself. It's not possible to be in a hot, warm, hot bathtub, die, and then be cold within an hour. It just doesn't make sense. And also the way she was found, her head was under the water, her feet was outside the bath, and it was like almost up against the wall. So she was like with her head under and the rest of the body above. And also the day before, her daughter, Bobby Christine, who was about, I think she was 18 at the time, she almost died exactly identical to the way that Whitney died. She was taking a bath, and her friend, they wanted to come and say hello to her, and they started knocking on the door. Nobody opened, and in the end, they almost had to kick in the door to go in there, and they found Bobby Christine almost unconscious in the bathtub. And there's a lot of speculation that since they rented the whole suite of the hotel, that there might have been some kind of laced champagne or something like that, and that is how this thing was this thing happened. Either that this champagne was aimed for Whitney, or that it was, they try to get both of them. I have no idea. I'm just pointing out some things that are quite mysterious. Also, during the night before she was found, I think it was about 2 a.m. in the morning, a guest that was staying at the floor underneath Whitney's apartment or suite suddenly noticed that there was a lot of water coming down through the ceiling. So he called the security, and they went up. And he said that this security guy who opened up the apartment to go in and check where the leakage came from, he said that this was the suite of Whitney Houston. And when they went in there, this guest, he noticed, one of the things he noticed was that there was a flat screen TV that was crashed. And also he had heard some, almost like somebody was falling or there was some loud noises and so on before they went up there.
So why do the Illuminati use water in these ritual sacrifices?
Once again, when it comes to the Illuminati and these rituals, there are other people that are a lot better with these things than I am. So I prefer that they speak about that. But I can say that it's a recurring thing that happens.
Why do the elite kill performers?
Once again, I think it is since I'm not part of the elite myself, I can't tell you for sure, but it's one of the things is that they do make like millions out of killing people like Whitney, absolute millions. And if you see the whole setup, I mean, it's when you look at these assassinations and you go into great details, you can see that there's a lot of preparation and very they normally take very big care of the date and the time and the, all of these things. And Whitney was, I'm sorry, your drink sounded really good. I'm going to take it.
Go ahead and take it.
Whitney was, she was famous, most famous for was all these love songs. And if you notice the date, this is just 2 days before Valentine. And also she had hardly died. I mean, before iTunes and Sony Music, and they almost doubled the price of her records, like with almost like it was on a standby. She was dead, boom, up went the prices. And the whole thing also, how they when you heard Clive Davis, he was giving an interview on the night just before she died. And he was talking about, he was presenting a new singer as the new Whitney Houston. They were preparing a new release of The Bodyguard. Do you know, like preparing a whole like redoing of Whitney, but in a new shape and not the old version of Whitney, but this new one.
So would it be safe to say or fair to say that it's almost like Sony or somebody plan Whitney's death?
I can only say that, you know, there's this famous Kebono, who benefits, follow the money. And if you do that, it's pointing in one direction, at least one major. And Sony would be very much in target there. Clive Davis as well, who's, because the thing is that after... It's one thing if she just died, but the thing was that they left her body in the hotel from the mid of the afternoon, early afternoon, until after midnight, while the whole music industry was just a few floors down having this pre-Grammy party. And I mean, they told the coroner to back off, leave the body there and so on. Very, very odd, I would say, the way that that was done. And once again, this points to what you were mentioning before, this weird thing of rituals that they do from time to time.
Ole, do you know, was Whitney there for the pre-Grammy party? Is that why she was really there?
As far as I know, yeah.
Okay. And they left her body in that room. Is that illegal?
I would at least say it's very odd to do a thing like that. I mean, somebody famous commits suicide, if that's the thing, or die of an accident, and you leave the body there for 8-9 hours while there is a massive party going on downstairs where she would be very much involved in the whole thing. I would say it's a very, very odd thing. And the security from the hotel, and so they said that the coroner were told off by them to please back off, take a step back. But as far as I've been able to find out, the order for that came from Clive Davis.
Now, who's this Clive Davis?
He was the guy who discovered her, and many other artists. He was a big name in the music industry.
I see. Now, I know this is a little outside of your area where you're comfortable about talking about, but do you think the energy in this party was somehow playing a role in this sacrifice?
I mean, that's where it's pointing at. I mean, what is the whole point of leaving her up there? I must say they're into very, very strange rituals, very strange energy things, very strange sexual behaviors, very much into the male energy and very much against the female energy. So I mean, for me, it's a very odd event, what happened there, and it points towards what you're saying. Also, the place where it took place, many of these assassinations are done in places where geometric. Yeah, it's exactly. You will find that often there's there's a Freemasonry symbol on the site beforehand, or it's like an obelisk is erected like within 100 meters from where somebody was killed within a year after it happened. And more often it's like a decoration of a park or something like that. Normal people won't understand that it's connected, but it pops up on a regular basis after somebody has been taken out like that. It's almost like a business card, or like I told you before, like it's giving the rest of us the finger, just marking territory and telling a story as well. Because as far as I understand, they are very proud of these things. So
it's so strange. It's so strange the way they do these things.
Yeah, I totally agree.
You know, with the water and the party going on and leaving the body there, it's very disturbing.
It is. I wouldn't call it healthy. I mean, and also when you look at the, I just want to say also that the drugs that was found in the bedroom in the hotel suite next to where she was lying was from the same chemist as Michael Jackson's drugs when he died was found, as well as the Mickey Free chemist in Los Angeles. I would also point out that there's a lot of these killings or an accident and assassinations that are carried out in Los Angeles. And I think I would say that the reason is that the police department is very, to some parts, very corrupt. And because of that is why they do it there. Because they really control it, the investigations in that area.
How does it affect you when you study these events? Do you find it depressing at times?
At times, it's awful. I mean, we're talking awful tragedies. But, I mean, there's so many, you know, every time somebody dies like this, you have families, it's a massive tragedy. And like I've been looking into so many, I've been speaking to witnesses, I've been, you know, like meeting family members, and it's awful. It's so sad. And
so you actually go and meet the family members sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes I do. I took my sweetheart, the first date I ever took her on was to go and see the widow of a police officer who had committed suicide by stabbing himself 15 times. I mean, very romantic.
Yeah.
but it's sort of like so, and this so-called suicide I'm talking about there, it's still to this day, it's labeled a suicide. But I mean, you try and stab yourself 15 times and then hit yourself in the face with some blunt instrument, you just can't do it. But this is also, it keeps repeating when you go into these different assassinations. It's often followed, if it's a big assassination, it's often followed like with a long line of killings or suicides, accidents, cancers, heart attacks, you know, if there is a conspiracy around it, because then there's a like almost two following conspiracies. One of silence that would just cover it up. You speak to the official sources, they will just, if there's a patsy involved, they will just point at the patsy, point at the patsy, point at the patsy. Whatever you say while you're looking for the real truth, they will just direct you to the patsy. And then there's the third conspiracy is the cleanup team that goes in and just takes care of people when they start fearing that maybe they will become a whistleblower, or they've seen too much, or they were part of the hit itself and needed to be taken out and so on. So often there's a long row of people, like with the Kennedy assassination, I think the list is almost 300 people now.
Jeez.
Yeah, it is incredible.
Now, that suicide you were telling us about, the suicide of the police officer, did that occur in Sweden?
Yeah, it did. His name was His name was Gustav Treisbach, and he was a police officer in a one of the major police stations in Stockholm. That was the one that controlled the area around the royal castle and the government buildings and so on. And there was a very strong buildup of Nazi police officers in the mid-1980s. And some of these police officers were later part of the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. But this man, Gustav Treisbach, he was getting very, very worried about these Nazis that was there. They were supposed to be under his command, but he had absolutely no control. They were untouchables. They were doing exactly what they wanted. And when he confronted them, that is when, after a few months of being totally harassed and so on, that is when one day he went out to pick up the mail and he didn't come back. And he was found after having officially stabbed himself 15 times and then hit himself in the head with something hard. So,
wow, crazy.
To this day, it's a suicide, to this very day. And it's signed, the suicide, the autopsy protocol is signed by one of the highest ranking pathologists in Sweden, Johan Reis, who is also involved in many other cases with a big question mark, I would say. So
the coroner or whoever the medical person was that claimed this was a suicide, that kind of makes him look corrupt too, right?
It's like Farmer Brown logic would say, yeah. And that is also when you see, this is when you start studying many of these different cases, you will see that it's the same key players that pops up again and again and again in different key positions. You know, sometimes they swap position just to give an illusion of a democracy, but it's still the same. And many times also when you see there's like a hidden network behind it, and this is the, I would say, very often involved within Freemasonry, Brotherhood, and so on. So this invisible network, the hidden hand that is moving in the background, is very much connected to that.
So you were talking about Nazis. Were there Nazis back in Sweden back in the 80s?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're talking, it was a police station called the Norrmalms police station. Like I said, it's the most central one in Stockholm. And at that time, that station was, they were almost being recruited to that station from the rest of the country. And we're talking not mild Nazis, but they were like Hitler salutes and this type of thing. You know, they were beating up people, killing them. There was a special group that was called the street cleaning group. They dressed in private clothes with baseball caps, baseball bats, and they went under the name of the Baseball Gang.
Oh,
and they were feared, absolutely feared. And later they were the Swedish part of the assassination. The assassination was carried out by an international hit team, because it's a massive hit, this conspiracy, this assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. It's absolutely not a Swedish murder. It's an international murder carried out by the same global elite as behind the JFK, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the whole long line. And this is where I've spent almost 30 years now trying to identify, and also managed to identify the people that actually carried them out, and being able to connect all of these different assassinations and terror acts.
So is there an international Nazi group still functioning today?
I don't understand the question. Of course there is, yes. But are you talking about within the Swedish police? Or
no, generally? I'm talking about worldwide. Is there
Really? Yeah.
Why don't you? I mean, I don't think all of us are as aware of that as you are.
No, but I would say that the global elite's agenda is the Fourth Reich. That's really what they're trying to accomplish. They're trying to accomplish a super state, a one world government, a one world country, sort of without borders. but with a one world army controlling the whole population, not defending it, controlling it, with a one world currency, get rid of a lot of us and save the rest of us more or less as working slaves for this Übermensch type of group, the global elite. It's a very depressing sort of view on the future if you want to go their way. And that is also why I put myself on the line doing all of these interviews to try and expose what is going on and so that we can turn this world into this beautiful place it's supposed to be. The whole nature is designed to be absolutely beautiful and in balance and harmony and all of these things. And there's this group that is not very big. It's only like 2,000-3,000 people in total, but they're just totally bullying us, the rest of us. And it's when you look at it, it's totally mad, because how can 2,000-3,000 people control 7 billion? It's an absolute joke that we're letting them do it. So it's big time wake up, I would say, and because it's only possible because we go along with it, we allow it, we even control each other, you know, so that they can carry out the agenda.
So after World War II, Ollie, do you think that Hitler lived in Argentina for a while?
I would say I know he did, yes.
Can you tell us a little more about that?
As far as I know, I mean, this, you know, the official stories that he committed suicide in the bunker, and then mm-hmm. they pulled out his body and put it on fire and so on. The thing was that the Russians afterwards they took the skull from it. It turned out that it was a woman's skull. So I mean, there goes Hitler, not dead that way. Instead, it seems like he was. Taken, as far as I know, there was a pilot taking him through from Tunde. It's in very close to the Danish border. They went there, he flew there, and then I think down here to Spain. Then he took a submarine, as far as I know, from here to Argentina, and then he stayed there for a while. I think he was in the States for a while as well, but in Argentina, where he bought I wouldn't call it a ranch, but like a farm, very, very particular in that whole layout and design. It looks like a normal house, but it's totally like a fortress, almost like that. And many of these ex-Nazis that went there, they used the same architect to build these houses. Yeah. And so on. So as far as I know, he was alive afterwards. And also when you see the key players in many, many of these assassinations comes from this group. You know, Alan Dulles, who was he was key in the JFK assassination. He was part of the Warren Commission. He was the CIA, former CIA director that was kicked out by JFK. He was the one who were part of building up the Gladio network in Europe after the Second World War, all the NATO countries. And what he was also part of arranging for Operation Paperclip, where they exported most people think, oh, thank God that Hitler, we stopped the war, he lost it, and thank God we got the Nazis in Nuremberg. They were sentenced, some of them died, fine, case closed, boom. No, the thing was that you imported thousands of these hardened Nazis into the American society and also into South America, where they were later part of building up the so-called OSS, which later turned into CIA, and also NASA and the banking system, and they just infiltrated the whole thing. So the Nazi war machine may have stopped, but not the Nazi power itself. Very alive.
There is a researcher named Joel Skousen who says that what the New World Order wants to do is to get World War III started, and they want to have the U.S. nuked, and then the New World Order is going to be the people that, quote-unquote, save the U.S. they're going to bring out their very advanced weapons. And then after this nuclear strike, he says that the people will be begging for the New World Order to protect them. So I don't know, have you gone into that aspect of this whole research? What do you think is the ultimate goal of the New World Order? How are they going to bring in this New World Order that's going to run everything?
Do you know, they've been using an old Roman tactic for years and years and years, decades and decades. It's called problem, reaction, solution. And in they've done that. If you want to, I can just go into a quick template of how they carry out, for instance, terror acts or something like that.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. I can give you the two templates that they use a lot. They have one for assassinations and one for terror acts or mass shootings. So I can line them up for you just so you can get a general idea. They're quite similar, actually.
Okay.
So which one do you want? An assassination or a terror act?
Let's do a terror act.
Okay. A terror act. If you study history and you go down to Argentina or Chile or so in the like Chile in 1973 and so on, when the Pinochet took over, he did a military coup overnight more or less and killed Salvador, the president, elected by the people, Salvador Allende. He killed him, and they took all the government. Everything was wiped out within a day or so. This was done with a backup of the CIA, and also the same team of assassins were very central in that. There's a group called Operation 40 that I can go into great details later if you want to, that are very, very central in all of these killings, and also the overtake of Salvador Allende. I just want to say, when it comes to dates as well, do you know what date this military coup was in 1973?
Mm, no.
9/11.
Oh.
There's many, many of these that, you know, the same dates occur again and again and again. Peter Tosh was taken out on 9/11, Salvador Allende 9/11. Exactly 10 years before 9/11, exactly 10 years before George Bush Sr., was the first time he openly spoke about the New World Order on the date of 9/11, but 10 years earlier. Anyway, when you see that how they did these military coups, what happened was that very quickly they got into a position of power. They knocked out the whole government and so on, and so they were in control of the country. At least they thought so. But what happened was that when the sun came up and people started seeing that, oh my God, our country has been invaded by military people, there were all these riots, there were demonstrations, there were, you know, so the military had to rush out and make mass arrests, fill big stadiums with people. They filled the jails, they had to torture them and interrogate them to find out where the rest of the people were hiding. And then they started executing them. When they executed people, they had problems with their families and relatives who wanted to find out what happened to them, so they had to kill them as well. And, you know, in the end, it was they almost needed as many soldiers as there were population to control it. So it was a mess, an absolute mess. So they learned from that. And nowadays, there's a modern version to it where they use this, it's called like a three-step rocket: problem, reaction, solution. So the whole idea is to secretly create a problem, to get a reaction from the population so that they will beg for the solution.
Mm.
So here, if we take a bomb, for instance, if you take 9/11 or Oklahoma City or 7/7 or the Madrid bombings, it's the same story again and again. So let's say that here in Spain, I'm the guy in power, and I want the police to have total, you know, liberty to kick in doors, to grab people with no warrant, to put them in jail forever and ever without a lawyer. I want the police to be able to carry around bazookas or drones or whatever, you name it, you know. I want them to have total power. I want tanks in the streets. I want, if I just do that, I have the power to do it, but if I just do it, I would have super problems with the population. I would have, once again, demonstrations, riots, underground movements, all of these things. There would be sanctions from other countries, financial sanctions, all of these things. Not the way to do it. So what I do instead, I secretly create a problem. In this case, a bomb. They love bombs. So the thing is, it's very important where I place this bomb. It needs to be in a public place where it affects as many people as possible. And the key factor as well is that it needs to hurt women and children, because what I'm trying to get is an emotional reaction from the population, not an intelligent one, emotional one. So it would be placed near a school, a daycare center, hospital, something like, it doesn't work with old people's home or anything like that. It needs to get emotional. So young children, young women, perfect. Sometimes they use nuns or nurses, that works fine as well. Old guys, sorry, no, that's not the way to go. Foreigners, no, it needs to be hit nationally in the heart. So while I prepare the bombs, it's always carried out nowadays also with a drill going on at the same time. And I think this drill is almost always identical to the real event. But the reason they do that is, I think, to be able to get the bomb in place without people really understanding what's going on, and also get whatever poor patsy they're going to blame it on in position so that they can blame him and so on, control the whole situation. So very often the drill goes halfway as a drill and then suddenly turns into a live thing, while people that are being part of it have absolutely no idea that it's suddenly gone live. Do you know, like in London when they blew up the subway, and there was a bus blown up there as well. There was a lot of policemen involved in the drill, and so they knew that there were bombs going on there, but they thought they were staged. And that, do you know, like it was not a fake event, just a drill. So when people came up, you know, blown up and dying, they were standing there saying, oh my God, it really looks so realistic, don't you think? And so these people asking for help, they didn't get, because the police officers thought it was actors. So the people were just lying there dying. It was, anyway, so we go back. So I prepare a bomb. I find a good place for it to be positioned. At the same time, I prepare Patsy. Because when it's bombs, they often use whole groups, but sometimes it's a lone person as well. If it's a group, it's somebody they have problems with anyway, so that they would have a possibility of getting rid of them at the same time. But if it's a person they aim at, then either it's a lone crazy guy, that is standard. They love the lone crazy guy, the Patsy one, because if he's alone, there's no conspiracy. It was a lone guy, so no planning. And the reason why they always want him crazy is because he was crazy. There was no motive either. So this is why they try and blame it on a lone Patsy. Lone Patsy is key here again. So every time you hear that, or lone crazy guy, sorry, every time you hear that, I would say big question mark at the side. Look into this case. Okay, so they prepare Patsy, and what they do is they get evidence prepared that will, as soon as the bomb goes off, would point in that direction. And sometimes they even leak out in media in the weeks coming up to this event. It's leaked out if it's a group. You know, they will leak out things that, ooh, this group has secret meetings on Wednesdays, and ooh, they might be planning something, and ooh, maybe they have guns under the you know, building in the walls, they're planning something. And this can be, you know, nowadays, if it hasn't started yet, it will be the truth seekers, or people like myself will be pointed out as crazy terrorists. But it might as well be the Mormons or the yogis or the Greenbird lovers, or you name it. I mean, they, as long as they have a Patsy, they're fine. If it's a lone person, It in the old days, it used to be the Russians or the East Germans, and so in the Cold War, those were the guys, the boogeymen that they could point out. Then after the Cold War ended, they needed a new boogeyman. So that's when they came up with this great idea, the Muslims. Ooh, the boogeyman. And they even have very dark mustaches and big eyebrows, look great in media. They look really scary. They have very strange names, and they come from countries that most people have no idea where they're lying. Perfect. So the poor Muslims have been used for decades as the boogeyman. And it's been so pumped into our subconscious that most people now, if you say Muslim, they hear terrorist. If you say Islam, they hear terrorism. That's it. You know, it's so pumped in. So I would say most of the time, absolutely not true. All of the events that I looked into, I'm not even sure there is such a thing as a real terrorist. I must say, because every single time they've been, if it's in the States, they've been equipped, trained, supported, financed by the same group of people, where the FBI is deeply involved of doing the training and supplying them with bombs and setting them up as so-called terrorists. So we're talking insider jobs here. Insider jobs. It's awful, absolutely awful. Anyway, so you prepared the patsy, you prepared evidence, you prepared the bomb. Also, now it's very important that I create the investigation as well. I need to control the investigation, so I have my own investigation on standby, where I can control the key people in the investigation. Their job is to just say, they went that away, they went that away, they went that away, and like a wall of no, no, no. So anyone like myself who's trying to get access to material or documents or evidence, it will be like hitting my head against a wall, and they will just point the official story, the patsy. That's their job. It's absolutely not to find out the truth. And it's very important to understand that they are part of the crime itself. Very important to see. And also, they are one of the tasks that this investigation has is to point out people like myself. If we keep digging too much, they would point us out and we will be taken care of. So it's a scary thing. I thought I could trust the police, for instance, in Sweden and so on. I'm not talking about the whole police force. I'm talking about key people, you know, rogue elements that are being used and so on. Okay, so everything is set up. Now the time is getting close to when we're going to let the bomb off. And once again, it doesn't work if it's in the middle of the night. It needs to be early in the morning. That's when people are most emotionally vulnerable. So they wait maybe 8:15, 8:30, something like that. And so we say here people are on their way to with their kids to daycare center or to work or something like that. It needs to be a time when people say, oh my God, it could have been me, as many as possible. So maybe 8:15, 8:20, something like that. And boom, off goes the bomb. What happens then is you pump out all these horrific images of blown up children and women in media, all of it made there to create this massive impact of terror to get the reaction. That was the problem, to get the reaction from the population saying, oh my God, something needs to be done. Something needs to be done. At the same time, I'm pointing at the patsy. It was them, it was them, it was them. And the population would turn to me, who they elected to deal with these things, and say, my God, please, you need to do something. And my reply would be, well, I can, but you know, with a violent group like these patsies, I really need to use a lot of force. So I need to let the police have tanks and booby traps and bazookas and drones and helicopters and whatever, you know, to blow these people up. And the population would say, yes, please do it, do it, do it. Not understanding that they're actually saying, please handcuff me even more, put more surveillance, steal more of my civil liberties, you know, take my rights away. And they will applaud me. And in I come with the tanks. You know, I have a national thing in the background, the theme. Flags are waving. Yahoo, I'm the hero. I'm coming in. I'm the hero. I'm knocking out the group I'm having problems with anyway. My agenda moves forward. And then what I do, they love martial law at the moment as well, you know, just to get people to use to the idea. They go in there, and then for 2-3 weeks, I leave my soldiers there. I shoot or kill or whatever the people, the patsies, or lock them up, or, you know, get rid of them, so that nobody can ask them and see that, oh my God, they're totally innocent. It's better if they're dead, you know. So what I do then is I leave my soldiers there. I put up a lot more surveillance cameras, for your security. It's for your security all the time. And then after 2-3 weeks, I say, okay, now the danger is over, so I withdraw. But I don't withdraw all of it. I will leave about 20% of it there. So suddenly you used to see like police and bulletproof vests, you're used to see like armored trucks, you're used to see this, and you will think, it's for my protection. They're doing it for my sake. And that's the whole idea. Mm. And then, if I can just, there's a little add to it as well, because if people start digging into this and saying, come on, there's something totally wrong here, and this criticism continues and continues and continues, and maybe there's some journalists who really start hitting, you know, then in the end they will say, okay, we will create a commission, and this commission will be put there. They will really find out the truth. Not right, because this commission is also part of the crime. This is also very important to see. The commission is part of this template that is being used. And the commission will look very much into not the crime, but the investigation. And they will spend like a year or so, you know, writing thousands of documents that says absolutely nothing. there would be internal scandals, maybe, so that one member had to leave and another one had to come in. And just because of that, we had to inform him about the whatever has happened up until now. So that would delay the whole thing for another 3-4 months. They love these things because the whole idea is to make time pass. So, and also there are lots of articles in the newspaper. So making the population so fed up in the end of this that they lose interest of finding out what actually happened. Then after a year or so, the commission will come out with a report, and the report will say, well, the investigation, they really tried and did their best, but they failed. They didn't do a good job, because this is especially if they haven't found or being able to nail someone for it. Anyway, so if that happens, then most of the population will say, fine, I don't even mention it. My head will explode if you talk about this again. But if somebody continues and continues and continues pushing, what they will do is they will appoint a second commission, and the second commission will look into what the first commission did, not looking at the crime, looking into where the first commission failed. And that would drag out for a year or so, same thing, thousands of documents saying absolutely nothing, and it will just continue like that. After the Swedish assassination of Olof Palme, there were 3 different commissions, almost 4. And it just, you know, like they will just appoint a new one until we're so fed up, and the years has passed and people are, oh, come on, why bother? It's been such a long time. I mean, what does it matter? It matters because the people who carried out these things are still in power. This is the thing. Why am I so interested in the JFK assassination, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King? Because the people who carried it out are still the ones in power. These white-haired guys in the White House and other places, they didn't come from nowhere. They are there for a reason. They have built a whole career on violence and a lot of corruptions and crimes, incredible criminality that are involved in this. So this is why our lives are where they are at the moment, because of these events.
So you saw this play out in Sweden. You saw the commission, and then the commission after the commission, and you've seen this whole template in detail. That's how you know all of this, correct?
No, I started with the JFK assassination. I was... The JFK assassination is the one of their masterpieces, if you want to call it that. I think 9/11 and JFK assassination, they stand out as the real ones. Then nowadays you have these mass shootings and so on, but it's like nowadays it's so sloppy, it's so low budget, it's so clumsily made, it's so, you know, like they don't even, many of these events don't even happen. They're using actors.
Sandy Hook,
Boston bombing, Woolwich beheading. It's just gone to a level where it's below criticism. It's so badly done. They even use the same actors. They you know, the same sheriff for three different mass shootings, three different states, same name, same hat, same sheriff. Come on. You know?
I didn't know that.
Oh, God, it's just pathetic. But we're buying it. So, I mean, who can blame them for keep doing it? I just want to mention also that the reason with these mass shootings and why they occur more or less always in the States is because it's problem, reaction, solution again time. What they want to is they want to make the weapons the problem. The weapons are the problem, not that it's some kind of madman that has a mental whatever disease. The reason that he was sick, that's the reason he's not. No, they want the weapon to be the problem, so that the solution would be for the population to give up their weapons. And when the population gives up their weapon, they can move forward much easier. So this is why all these mass shootings occur. They want the population to give up their arms. I just want to say, I'm not a person pro-violence, pro-hate, pro-fear, none of that. I totally do not believe in that. But I also see, when you study history, when there are like presidents or so who have demanded that from the population, it has been people like Stalin, Mao, Hitler, these type of people, and the results have been very scary. So I would very much recommend people to keep their arms. Do not use them, but keep them.
Sounds like reasonable advice to me. I just got notified by the station owner here that YouTube has destroyed our YouTube account and disabled our videos. So I'm not sure what's going to happen there. And I think...
Can I just say... you are like the fourth show or something like that I'm on where this has happened. I'm not saying it's because of me. I'm saying because of truth seekers are being targeted at the moment.
Wow.
So what they do is first the YouTube channel is sometimes charged with that there's some kind of legal thing that you don't have authority to publish. You know, you don't have the rights to the images, or you don't have this. And they bombard you with that for a while, and then they just delete the account, boof, like this. It's happened for Gold Channel, it happened for Capricorn Radio, it's happened for you, there was somebody else just the other day. Do you know,
so it's, this is a trend that's going on right now.
Yeah, very much so.
We're taking a break, we'll be back in about 5 minutes.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message. Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind.
Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And you will catch The Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's The Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Hi, everybody. It's me, the Fetch, host of Inside the Eye Live. Before the Sunday mainstream media, political pundit talk shows, there is Inside the Eye Live, where we break down some of the weekly mainstream media talking points before the talking points even get aired. Add in some entertaining stories, weather, cats, intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
There is no denying the world is awakening. We see it in the global uprisings and demonstrations of the people around the planet and the new way of thinking and living that is arising naturally within each one of us and our communities. I have been a major player in this global shift and movement for over 20 years and have helped tens of thousands of people around the world change their lives and find their voice in order to help create the paradigm change we so desperately need. Join me here at Revolution Radio on the Jess Bernard Show every Tuesday at noon Eastern Time for 2 hours of powerful interviews and discussion with some of the most influential visionaries of consciousness, alternative media, and suppressed knowledge. We promise to reveal the real matrix and empower your human experience.
The finder of lost children and missing persons. Surveillance, civil and criminal investigations.
I investigate.
No, I am the chosen one.
Do not underestimate the power of good, and do not dismiss the strength of the child.
Yes, every Wednesday evening on Revolution Radio, come join our very own eye investigatrix, Monique Lassan, with her private eye X-Files.
So you're the finder of lost children.
Private Eye X-Files, every Wednesday from 10 to midnight Eastern, Studio B, on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
I realize it's very hard for you to take in. But it's your destiny to find the golden child.
There is no good and evil. There is only power. And those too weak to seek it.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Be sure to tune in weekdays 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time for Strange Universe with Sean David Morton. A strange, interesting, and engaging wide variety of topics. So be here. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
I would like, if I may, to take you on a strange journey.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Our guest this evening is Ole Damegaard. His website is www.lightonconspiracies.com. He has a book. It's called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. It's a deep investigation of the assassination of Olof Palme. And he also talks about the JFK, RFK assassinations in his book. And I think, Ole, you also are looking into doing a movie. Is that true?
I'm very much trying to get a documentary made, a top quality documentary that will show how all of these different assassinations are very deeply connected. And I would very much like to, in this hour, just go into some details about the team that they've been used to carry out these assassinations over the decades.
Let me just make one quick statement. I want to remind everybody that we are listener-supported radio as well. So please press the PayPal button and make a donation. And you can probably do the same kind of thing on your website too, Ole, right? Make a donation at your website?
I'd say it's extremely appreciated. It's very hard to do this kind of type of research with no funds, so extremely appreciated. I also got a newsletter that you can sign up for, and so any type of that, or buy the book.
And what's on your newsletter?
I try to show, go into many of these different conspiracies and show the behind the scene what actually happened, and go into some great detail so that people for themselves can see what took place instead of the official story that we're being fed.
And you wanted to talk a little more about Operation 40 in the second half of the show. And I hope we have time to get back to the music industry as well. I got some more questions about there. But wasn't Operation 40, wasn't that actually a group that was started by Eisenhower? And I always thought of Eisenhower as one of the good guys.
In this thing there, I mean, good guys, bad guys, who knows? I mean, many of these assassins, they see themselves as freedom fighters, but I can't see the hero type of part. If you blow up, for instance, an airliner or something like that, killing 76 people or whatever, I can't see that is an act of a freedom fighter or a hero. I would call that a real terrorist. And this is what they've been carrying out, so many assassinations over the years. I mean, we're talking up in the thousands. So, no, it's exactly like you say. In the early 1960s or late 1950s, President Dwight Eisenhower they were starting to have a major problem on Cuba because the Fidel Castro was becoming stronger and stronger. And one of the things that he did when he took over the island was to throw out all the casinos, all of the foreign financial interests and so on, which was a major problem, not only for the mob, but also for the government, and because it was quite infiltrated, and also many of these big American companies and so on. Plus that Cuba was part of the drug trade, where the final step in before the United States were Cuba, the planes landed there and so on. So when Castro took over, major problem. So Dwight Eisenhower gave his vice president, Richard Nixon, the task of forming, together with Alan Dulles and other hardened CIA veterans, to create a team of highly skilled assassins. It went under the name of Operation 40. It was a super secret group that has been, went super secret for many, many years. Nobody had heard of them as far as I know. But this team was under the supervision of some CIA people. The people were people that had proven themselves earlier on. They were part of, in 1954 in Guatemala, when they took out the president there. They were part of other operations, and also, I think, partly in Iran when they got rid of Mossadegh and got the Shah in power there. And the reason why they created this at this time was they wanted to aim this violent cannon almost at Fidel Castro. So the CIA people that they used were people like Ted Shackley, the so-called the Blonde Ghost, which was he's so central in I can't name enough assassination globally. Another guy was E. Howard Hunt, which was later quite famous for being one of the Watergate burglars. He was also very central in the JFK assassination, and many, many, many others. Another guy was David Attlee Phillips. Now, David Attlee Phillips, he was later the station chief in Mexico City, and he was also the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald, the man to become the blame for the JFK assassination, but who was actually employed both by the FBI and the CIA. And like I say, David Attlee Phillips, who also went under the name of Howard Benson and Maurice Bishop, was the one controlling him.
Can I throw a quick question in?
For sure.
How did you learn about this Ted the Blonde Ghost Shackley? What an interesting sounding name.
Yeah, I know. He was called the Blonde Ghost because he very rarely appeared on photos, photographs. He always avoided that. So he was like a person who was there but didn't really exist. But well,
how did you find out about him?
30 years of digging into documents, books, documentaries, speak to witnesses, speak to people that were involved, speak with, you know, I'm a former journalist. It's like digging. And now this, I tell you, if you Google his name, there would pop up a whole lot of things about him. I'm not sure about that. But when I started, which was in the early 1980s, you didn't have the internet. So I had to go a totally different way. And that was the very hard way to do it.
So was he one of the assassins that was picked by Eisenhower?
No. He was one of the people that was training and controlling the assassins, because the assassins themselves were mostly exiled Cubans that had escaped from Cuba and gathered in Miami, and they were recruited by people like David Attlee Phillips and Ted Shackley and so on. Most of them were former police, military, Air Force, violent people, and very brutal, many of them.
Was this Jose Dormo one of these characters too?
Jose Perdomo was one of them, yes.
Perdomo.
Jose Perdomo.
Was he a Cuban?
Yeah.
And he was one of the actual assassins, right?
He was part of the assassin. He was, for 10 years, he was one of the highest ranking officers in that group, yeah.
And was this group originally created by Eisenhower?
He was the one that asked for them to be, he was the one that gave the task of creating them, yes. And Nixon was the one that was in charge of doing it. And the guy that they put to fund the whole thing or to get the finances for it was a man by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush.
Wow.
And his right hand when it came to this was a man called Felix Rodriguez, who was later very, very central in the whole Iran-Contra scandal, because the whole Iran-Contra affair is built up around people in Operation 40. They're so central, I tell you, these people. So also the same Felix Rodriguez, I mean, he was working very closely to Oliver North. He was also the guy that was given the task to track down Che Guevara, who was one of Fidel Castro's partners, and they tracked him down in Bolivia, and they found him, and Felix Rodriguez gave the order to get him executed, and the one who executed him was a man by the name of David Morales. He was also CIA, part of Operation 40. He was also part of the assassination of Robert Kennedy at the Ambassador Hotel in 1968. Very, very brutal man. And he went for, he was said to be the top assassins for the CIA in South America.
So Operation 40 was originally created by Eisenhower to disrupt Cuba and get Castro out of power?
Yeah, that was one of them. But I mean, at that time they were looking globally as well, you know, because they wanted a hit team that could be sent from country to country and just eliminate people they wanted to take out. If Eisenhower was aware of this, I do not know. But because I think he was almost hijacked. You know, if you listen to his bye-bye speech, when he steps down as president, he's very much warning for the military-industrial complex. I think he had no idea what he was part of creating, and I mean, this is the whole power structure that is still in place to this very day.
Are you still optimistic about the future?
I'm super optimistic.
I'm glad. It's easy to get depressed when you know.
I've been depressed. I've been paranoid. I've been all of these things. But that was during the years when I felt totally alone. You know, I had people murdered. I had two friends who got murdered around me. I left Sweden. I moved to Spain because it was getting too close. When that was one of the major reasons. And I was getting very scared. But now there's such an awakening going on. It's so wonderful to see such a spiritual awakening going on at the same time, you know, and as far as I can see, the global elite, they are in not a very nice place at the moment. It's falling apart around them. This is also why I think they're getting so sloppy, because they're trying to speed it up. In the old days, they used what was called stepping stones, you know, just a little step here, a little step out to the right, a little step in the middle, so that you wouldn't notice really what's going on. But now it's just full speed ahead.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because when you were talking about Sandy Hook and some of these other operations, they're so obviously faked that I'm still amazed that a lot of people in the public, they just still don't get it. Or they're so distracted by their daily life that they just kind of overlook it. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
It's designed like that on purpose. You know, people are being this whole financial situation was designed like this to keep people pressed down. You know, by being so. You know, pushed down by debt and mortgages and all of these things, so that it's just a matter. It's very important for them not to get so that normal people would get hungry, because if they really get hungry, starving, you have a revolution. So they try and keep us as broke as possible, but still with food, you know. And this is also so designed so that you won't have the extra strength to look at these things.
Do you talk about these kinds of...
Yeah. Sorry?
Well, my question is, do you talk to people in your daily life about these assassinations at all? Do you bring this up at all?
Among my friends and normal people?
Yes, normal people.
No, not at all. No.
Well, I tell you, the reason I bring that up is because one of the topics I discuss on the show is Fukushima, and I've started to bring that up to quote-unquote normal people. Mm-hmm. And I have found that only 3 people out of 21 even knew what Fukushima was. Wow. So when you're talking about people being just heads down, they're just so heads down.
Yeah. Do you know, I think that most people, when it's a painful awakening for many people, and you can't force it. So I think the only one you can focus on is yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, it is for yourself to wake up. It's for you to fill yourself with a light energy, you know, not the dark. Because the thing is, most people that become aware of these conspiracies, you know, they go into getting so obsessed about it. They study everything. I'm talking about myself as well, the way I used to be. So you go so into it, and it's just so black and so dark and so evil that people around you are just like, oh my God, could you just keep quiet? You know, I don't want to hear. And so I was like that for a few years, and then I just came to a point where I saw I can't push this down other people's throat. It's only if they're interested. If they ask me, then I will talk. So I went quiet for quite a few years. didn't mention this at all until somebody showed a real interest. Then I said, okay, fine. And then pick my brain. I gave them everything. Yeah.
Mm.
And then now I've since 15 months or something like that, I've been doing all of these interviews. So I speak on interviews, and the rest of the time I talk about chicken and hug my daughter and hug a neighbor, you know, whatever. But I don't talk about these things.
I bet you actually even sometimes get tired of talking about it. I mean, it's good to talk about something else is what I'm trying to say.
It is, but I feel because I feel so optimistic and so positive about the future, I get a great feeling. I tell you, if you go to my website, the guest book there, I get messages from people all over the world. Such beautiful messages, you know. But it's because I come from my intention is to spread forgiveness and compassion, love and healing to the world by exposing this. You know, it's like a cancer grows inside this beautiful body. It needs to be exposed, even though it's really painful and smelly and so on. It needs to be exposed, because if not, the body will die. But if it gets exposed, the body has the possibility to heal itself. And so this is my intention. And because my intention comes from the heart, the responses are beautiful. I haven't been threatened. I haven't been, even though I point out people right, left, and center, name them, all of these, up until this day, knock on wood. I haven't been taken out. I haven't been threatened. I haven't been anything like this. And the messages I get is like things like, you know, now I start to believe in humanity again. I've stopped believing in hatred. I stopped believing in revenge. Now I can see that there's a way forward. These type of thing, you know, it makes me so, so grateful to be part of this and be able to do my share in the whole thing.
Did this Operation 40 group then decide to kill Bob Marley?
They were part of it, but we're talking about mechanics. They have no, it's not them giving the orders. They're just being, they're good at what they're doing, and they've been sent to carry out these assassinations on a very, very regular basis. When it comes to Bob Marley, I would say that the one of them that was part of doing the attack on him was a man called Luis Posada Carrillas. He was there. He was in Dealey Plaza. He was part of the group that made the shooting where they tried to kill Bob Marley earlier. But Bob Marley didn't die there. He was wounded. But he still carried out this. There was a very big concert that would follow just a week after he was shot, or just a few days after.
His wife get shot?
Yeah, she was shot in the back of the head, and his manager as well.
Did they both die?
No, none of them. All of them. It was a miracle that they survived. Yeah.
Man.
No, she was
so
hit in the head.
He went the next day and played at a concert with. Was there still a bullet in him?
Yeah.
Seriously?
I tell you, Bob Marley, if people think that he was just sitting around smoking spliffs, you are making a major mistake. This was a strong individual, very, very strong. And that was also why they feared him, because this was a man, you know, that said, stand up, wake up, you know, stand up for your rights. Let's join hands. Let's do not accept this anymore. And he was becoming a symbol, you know, for the African people also. And so this thing when he was shot at, it was just before there was this big concert he had been asked to take part of, because at that time there was a lot of problems on Jamaica, because the CIA with David Attlee Phillips, Henry Kissinger, the same people as always, had come, and the whole island of Jamaica was just being, you know, there was so much sabotage, arsons, there were shootings, they were pumping the island with all of these automatic weapons and so on. And Luis Posada Carrillas was sent in as well to, as far as I've been able to find out, to lead this group of assassins to take out Bob Marley, because what he was wanted to do at this concert was to bring together the political leaders on the island, which he also did in front of all this big audience. He got both of the two political leaders up on stage, shaking hands and uniting them. So, but then what happened after that, you know, because people thought that he was going to be assassinated on stage, but he didn't. And just, I think it was about a week later, he was still surrounded by his own bodyguards and so on. And then he was approached by a filmmaker by the name of Carl Kolbe. Now, Carl Kolbe is not just anyone. Carl Kolbe is the son of Bill Kolbe, the former director of the CIA. And he was he approached Bob saying that he wanted to make a documentary about him and so on. And also as a sign of appreciation, he had brought him a pair of boots, cowboy boots. And Bob Marley was very much into, you know, jeans and keeping fit, and he loved boots as well. So what he did, he was really happy, you know, and he pulled one of the boots on, and there was an LA photographer there, a prize-winning guy, who saw the whole thing happen. And he said that Bob suddenly shouted, and he was like, oh, and pulled off the boot, and inside it there was a piece of copper wire that had punctured his big toe. And that is exactly the same big toe as he later developed cancer in. I don't know about you, but I sure don't know a lot about people that have had cancer in the big toe. But that was the cancer that it started there. And it, I don't know, I mean, he was very strong physically and mentally and so on. I think that was one of the reasons why he lasted that long. Plus that he was smoking a lot of marijuana, which is very... a strong anti-cancer thing. Hmm. If that is why he lasted that long, because he died just a few months after John Lennon, which was like 4 or 5 years later. But that was also after he was being helped or approached by a doctor with a background. This background I'm not totally sure about, but the official story says that this he had a background as in Auschwitz, Nazi background, and that, I mean, it's a very strange thing that you have this former Nazi doctor taking care of a Rastafari. And also his family, Bob Marley's family, his mother came there, and she said that he was being treated awful, and in great pain, and that this doctor was just almost like torturing, and then he died very young. Mm. The common thing with most of these people is that they stand up for peace, and the agenda of the global elite is death, destruction. That's the thing. So when you have a public person who really stands up for peace, and that where many, I mean, in this case, millions of people are listening to them and really following what they say, that is when they're taken out. Like John Lennon, Lady Diana, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, these type of people.
So why is the global elite so focused on creating a war environment? Why do they want to stir up so much trouble? Do you know?
I think that what we're looking at is almost like a very high-tech modern version of all the old stories, you know, we grew up with, you know, the young knight fighting the dragon, you know, you've always got these stories, and we live in a universe of duality where you need right to be able to see left, you need up to be able to understand what down is, you need happiness to be able to understand what sorrow is, and so on. And you need evil to be able to see, understand what good is, and to make the choices. And this group symbolizes, in my world, the absolute evil. And what we're trying to achieve is the absolute good. And this is sort of like, it's very much like a spiritual awakening going on, where we need this darkness. Even though it's awful to say that, but this is, you know, this is...
Say do that. You think the Vatican and the Jesuits play a role in this?
Big time.
Have you studied that at all?
I would say that you got three centers in the world that are working together. You got the financial center in London, and you got the war center in Washington, and you got the religious center in the Vatican. And there's a lot of interaction going on between the three of them. It's just three parts of a pyramid shape, if you want to say that. And the Vatican's are so central in weapons, drugs, pedophile gangs, all of these things, and also controlling the population with religion, big time.
Yes.
So yes, very central.
Well, you know what I thought of since I've kind of studied your work is the analogy I see, and I know this will be very controversial to a lot of people, is that a lot of these stars, they're almost like a savior figure, and then they kill them off. And when they kill off the savior figure, it kind of takes all of our power away. And I think they're doing this kind of thing over and over and over and over. And it's almost like some kind of strange ritual that's communicating somehow with our subconscious. Have you ever looked at it in those terms?
I have, and I think, you know, hope is one of the strongest powers. But so if you can crush hope, then you can push down people easier. And I think that is when, you know, when JFK and Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, there was a lot of hope in those years, a hope to make a difference, a hope to make a change to the world, a hope to join the world, you know, to unite mankind. And it was taken out, you know, when Bobby Kennedy was killed just a month after Martin Luther King, it like most people who were alive and were involved in the whole movement at that time, they said hope just died. We couldn't take anymore, you know, so they just gave up. And that was their whole idea.
Do you think this same group killed Elvis?
I know. I don't know enough to answer that, and I as far as I know, I don't think he was murdered. So I'm the wrong person to ask about that.
Okay, this would be a little speculation on your part. I don't know, you probably don't like to speculate, but to me, Miley Cyrus seems like another good candidate for them to kind of do the same thing they did to Whitney too.
Just like you say, I don't want to speculate.
You don't want to speculate?
No.
Okay. Fair enough. But it seems that we see this repeating pattern in the music industry.
Yeah.
Do you think that one of the things that the Illuminati tries to do is to kind of keep us in a lower mindset? Do they use... Okay, haven't you talked about rap music was designed? I shouldn't say. Is it hip hop that was?
It's hip hop.
Hip hop.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
I wouldn't say that it's designed, but it was. There was a meeting. I think it was in Los Angeles, in as far as I remember, in the early 1990s, where I have this. There is a letter circulating on the internet. That is where I've got it from. One of the sources has been confirmed from other sources as well. But he says that this man that I don't know the name of, he says that he was working high up in the music business at that time. I think in 1980, something like that. And the whole music business was really up and going, very positive and so on. And one day he was called to a meeting, a private meeting, and he went there. And quite a few other people from the music business as well were called to the same meeting. They went to this big villa in somewhere in, I think, Los Angeles. And when they came in there, he was very almost shocked because there were businessmen there, very serious businessmen that he'd never seen before. They weren't introduced by name or anything like that. There were bodyguards surrounding them on the walls, around in the room, and so on. And they were asked to sign an agreement of confidentiality, never to reveal anything that would be said at this meeting. One guy refused to do it. He left. But this guy, he was too curious to do that, so he stayed. And what they presented at this meeting was that they were big investors in private prisons. And one of the things that they wanted to do was to invest in the music business, but in a way that would glorify violence, crime, all of these things, to help generate more of this violence, destabilization of society and so on, get the crime rates up, get the minorities to really start fighting and so on. And what they wanted to was promote hip-hop, and they more or less ordered the people in the music business to back up and push forward hip-hop. At that time, hip-hop was looked upon as like, what is this kind of crap? I mean, it's not even music, and rap as well. What is it? They're just talking, they can't even sing. You know, people in the music business was laughing at it. But after that meeting, the whole scene changed, according to this source. And the whole music business as well changed, the videos, all of this ritualistic, there's a lot of rituals in music videos nowadays, Freemasonry signs, Freemasonry symbols, they're just all over the place. I mean, if you're interested in these type of things, I mean, look at what's this big sport event in the States, this...
Super Bowl.
I mean, it's just mind-blowing when you look at it. If you start to learn about the languages and the symbols they're using, it's just like, oh my God. And really? People are just sitting there applauding, yay, give me one more. It's very sad to say, but the music business nowadays, I would say, is totally infiltrated. Also, to a great extent, the film industry. And they've been working for generations trying to centralize the power to fewer and fewer. And they've gone into all the main areas where they can reach the big population. So these are some of the main areas.
Do you think that some kinds of music can actually be mentally debilitating?
I don't know about that, but I know that if you take water crystals, if you have seen the work of, I think his name is Emoto Masuru, where he takes photos of frozen water crystals, and he's found out that the water crystals are like really alive, that the water is an alive liquid, which is also why it's so necessary for any type of life. And if you play like beautiful classical music and stuff, the water crystal just turns into like rainbow spectra colors, beautiful shapes, all of this. But if you take like death metal or things like that, and you sing about, you know, kill and rape and plunder, all of these type of things, the water crystals just go into like, they look like muddy water, like oily, awful, ugly shapes. And so for sure it will, that sound energy can affect our bodies and our minds in a very strong way. That is proven scientifically.
Yeah, the reason I bring that up is because it does to me seem like that the elite use these pop stars to keep the public in a kind of mental fog, so that we're not capable of higher thoughts. And I wonder if these music people are trying to hypnotize the public. For example, I think some of the music is designed to get you focused on just an emotional state totally. Or some music is trying to get you focused into a physical state, maybe sex. But very little music now appeals to your higher kinds of thinking. I wondered if you had noticed that in your research at all.
For sure. It's like they are not stupid, these people. Absolutely not. I mean, they're very intelligent, and they use all type of you know, like public relations and skilled, very skilled people in many different areas to manipulate us in whatever way they can. So, and especially through TV, I would say that is one of the main ways to get to us is through TV, and but also through music, all of these. The main thing for them is to push us down, to keep us down on as low energy level as possible. You know, that's why they use fear, terror, all of these things. When you put on the news, it's just awful, 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 awful. Push you down, push you down, push you down, so that you won't start to see, because that's where they can control you. So, because if you start filling your heart with gratitude and empathy and passion and compassion, you raise your energy. And I tell you, this is not just a New Age wee. This is a fact. They have a lot more problem to control you there, because they can't get to you in the same way. And this is why they try to push us down, push us down. This is also why when I dig into these very dark areas and I put myself on the line, I totally focus on not to get buy into fear, not getting into paranoia, not getting into the, but instead focus on being grateful for everything I have around me, you know, see my beautiful family, see, my God, I've got a bed to sleep in, focus on these things and just raise the energy, raise it. And I think this is also a way to, for people, normal people that say, but oh my God, there's no way out of this. We're so powerless. They're so powerful. It's all over, you know, end game. I would say absolutely not. But the thing, the way you can do it is by raising your energy. And the best way of doing that is to help someone else, you know, to get out of your own misery, reach out a hand and help someone else. That will raise your energy. You will feel good about it. The person receiving will feel good about it. Other people who see you do this kind of act of kindness will feel better. And it raises, and you can find options to, you know, like instead of drive-by shooting, do drive-by acts of kindness and lift it. You know, you don't drive down the toll road, pay for the car that comes behind you. You know, all of these anonymous things that can be so powerful, that can really, and that helps to lift it. And then also by understanding more and more about the different templates that they're using, the different methods they're using to control us. I mean, one major way to get out of this is turn off the box, turn it off, you know, and start seeing, oh my God, I've got a wife, I've got kids, maybe I should start talking to them, I could even play with them, you know, go out, hug a tree, hug a neighbor, hug a police officer, these type of things, lift it, and you will be harder and harder in control, and you will see your life around you will start changing. People around you will start changing because you will be attracting other circumstances. So I would say, do not buy into the fear. Do not buy into what you're being pumped with. This is a beautiful world, and they're trying to make us believe that it's a place of horror and you can be killed and terrorized at any time. Not true at all. Absolutely not true.
Our thoughts affect our health a whole lot. So we want to keep our thoughts positive to keep our own health. Otherwise, I mean, if you dwell on the negative, it can actually negatively affect your health, don't you think?
Big time.
And I think you give some real good advice. Turn off the TV. I've heard the flicker rate on the TV kind of puts you in a hypnotized state.
Why do you think it's called TV programs? It's programming. It really is. And they're doing it. They're not stupid. They know how to get to us. And also, through the iPads, iPods, iMacs, you name it, all of these I, that is also, I mean, look at how people are hooked up to the net. I mean, totally controlled. This little machine in their hand that they didn't even know existed like 10, 15 years ago, now they're totally hooked to it. You know,
yeah, I'm not a cell phone person. I keep mine off. But most people have to have their cell phone on all the time. That's a huge change. Because totally. People, I mean, personally, I kind of like not being interrupted anytime someone wants to interrupt me. But today, people are lost without their cell phones.
But this is the whole thing, to see how we're being controlled. I mean, I don't mind high tech at all. But it's when you see the result, when you see that people don't, they stop talking to each other. People are sitting around in a restaurant. You know, the only thing they're doing is taking a photo of the food for Facebook. They don't communicate. They said, now I'm in the cinema, now I'm in the restaurant. Nobody speaks to each other anymore. Go to Sweden. It's like, what the hell happened here? It's so really? High tech, and it's so, people are getting so isolated away from each other. Right?
That so, is, I think, part of the transhumanism movement.
Yeah.
Is that the elite, they have this idea that they are going to merge us with machines. I don't even like to talk about it. It's so negative, but that is part of their plan. Have you studied that at all? That's probably outside of your area, right?
It is. I haven't.
Yeah.
It's also, I since there are a lot of dark things that I'm looking into, I try to avoid too much of it because, you know, areas where I don't need to go, I don't go because I don't want to be dragged down either.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying. A lot of kids today can't even talk, hardly, because they're so used to texting. That's all they do.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed that? People have a hard time conversing?
Yeah, and they can't spell either. And I mean, it's a language of their own. Just one letter is here, there. You know, like script, very strange things.
And we started talking a little bit about John Lennon. Wasn't he about to go on a peace tour before he was assassinated?
Yeah, exactly. Here we are. Here we go again with somebody who stands up for peace, you know, give peace a chance, stop going to war, doing all of these things. And just like you say, he had just recorded his comeback album together with Yoko Ono. And he was planning this big peace tour that first for the States, and then I think they were planning to go for the rest of the world as well. So there was a massive movement that could become a big threat to the elite. So what happened was that you have this guy that is, he's sentenced for the assassination. His name is Mark Chapman. I would say a perfect patsy. He looks a bit weird, mentally weak, and so on. And the official story said that he was there waiting the whole day to get an autograph from John Lennon, and that he was obsessed with him and so on. He wanted to be famous. He was a lone patsy. He wanted to do all of this old one. Anyway, the limo came from the studio, parked outside the Dakota building in New York. And Yoko Ono left the limo first, and she was about 5-6 meters ahead of John when he left. And according to the official crime scene notes, Mark Chapman was standing to the right, and Lennon passed him, and he was in the sort of like in the middle of entering. There's a big entrance to this Dakota building. When I think it was 5 shots were fired, Lennon went down, started crawling into the building. Yoko came out, and they took him to a hospital. He was taken there and pronounced dead. But in the meantime, there was a doorman this evening, and he's said to have run over to Chapman, taken his gun away from him, shouted, "Do you know what you did? You just killed Lennon." And then Chapman was just standing like a zombie, waiting to be picked up more or less when the police came later on. But when you look at the crime scene, you have Chapman, he was standing to the right. You have John Lennon, who was shot. Now, where was the shot fired from? They came straight from the left, not from the right. So here comes Farmer Brown again. What happened? Who was standing to the left, and how could that happen? Now, the shots were fired very rapidly and very closely. It said that the coroner had almost problems seeing some of the shots if they were because they were so close together. So that suggests that the shooter was standing very close to him. And at this evening, there was a doorman, very nice looking elderly gentleman, glasses, a bit bald, I think late 60s, something like that. And this guy's name popped up right after the assassination, and then it disappeared. He was mentioned as the doorman in some articles, but after that, nothing was mentioned until 7 years later. The only reason why I reacted was because I had looked into Operation 40, because this man's name was José Perdomo, and like we mentioned before, he was one of the highest ranking officers in Operation 40, this highly, highly skilled team of assassins for 10 years. So, I mean, what are the odds of this man working extra as a doorman exactly when this occurs?
Are these assassins sometimes killed then when they're of no longer any use?
I have not heard of José Perdomo after that, and many of them have met a very violent end, yes. It's like the old gunslingers, you know, they live with a gun, they die by the gun, and it's the same.
Do you think the Illuminati kill them off?
They get themselves to kill each other, you know.
Oh, really? Okay.
But also there's been like a death squad almost that has followed after the JFK assassination, that has followed over the years and cleaned up. And there are two members of this hit team that I'm being part of exposing at the moment. They're both living in Toronto, and they are responsible for, I would say, at least 1,000 people's death over the years. They were active from the late 50s and all the way up until today, more or less.
So two people have assassinated 1,000 other people?
According to a very a witness that I trust, who's been, she grew up with them, and she's been living very closely to them. She's been witnesses some of the assassinations and so on, which has been everything from children to women to men as well. I mean, they've been used by the mob and the CIA and the government for all of these years. Their name is Walter Tobinski and Clyde Forshaw. These people, I would say that it's one of the biggest scandals in modern times, as far as I can see, that they have been used and allowed to carry out all of these assassinations for so many years, even though the government has been aware of them. I mean, the government has even been using them. And the reason why this witness, a very, very brave woman, has tried for years to reveal what has been going on is because she says that what she's been wanting is for all the victims' families to get closure, to finally get an explanation to what happened to their child, father, mother, and so on. But these have been part of a death squad that has been, they were part of also these different operations I spoke about before with the Iran-Contras. They were in Iran, they were in Guatemala, they were sent in many different areas. They were also part in Dealey Plaza in the assassination itself.
And how old are these people?
They're quite old now. Clyde was born 43, I think, and Walter Tobinski was a few years older.
So they're in their 70s?
Yeah, or later. Yeah. No, older. So, yes, 70s and all. But they're using steroids to look younger, and Clyde is to this day a bank robber together with some family members.
Wow.
He's the so-called a vault bandit, and well, in Toronto there's a long series of robberies, and there's this old guy doing them. It's absolutely incredible. And ATM machines as well, they've been hitting a lot of those. Clyde is said to have done like two killings per week for years and years. He's been working as a bus driver, also driving one of these streetcars in Toronto, using that as a cover for, you know, as an alibi, and also as a, you will see that many of these killings are around along the routes of the streetcar that he's been driving. So it's a super scandal, you know. And I think one of the reasons why they've done everything to keep the lid on, to cover this whole thing up, is that if the families of these all of these victims would sue the American state and the Canadian state, I think the countries would just collapse, you know, financially, because we're talking about amounts that would just be unreal.
So basically, these governments have just been looking away while these assassins work.
No, they have used them.
They've actually used them, yeah, of course.
This is what, you know, like when you see the governments today, to get up to that level, you would have to prove your loyalty. And we're looking at people, in my opinion, when you look at people like Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, George Bush Sr., many of these other, Dick Cheney, Ramsey, and so on, we're talking criminals on a scale that is mind-blowing when you look into it. When you really start digging into it, it is unreal. It is absolutely unreal. And so I can only say it really is time to wake up and stop this madness that has been going on for such a long time.
Well, we've just got a couple minutes left. Ole, did you want to tell people again about your website and your book and anything else you want to finish the show with?
Yeah, I would love that. My website is Light on Conspiracies. That is a very, it's not a random name. It's very intentional. LightOnConspiracies.com. My book is called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. I've got several other books on the website as well. And like I say, I'm extremely grateful for any type of donations, or if you would buy the book or something. It's 30 years of my life that I put into this. And also, I would very much like to end with a prayer. I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. At least I'm trying to. And I've got this beautiful yoga teacher of mine who ends with this prayer. And it goes like this. May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.
Go ahead. That was great. Beautiful.
It is beautiful, and it is, some people react a lot against it, but I feel that the only way to stop this is by, you know, love is the healer. It is a massive healer. And it's only when this dark, empty hole that I believe that these people have inside of them, that's why they have this enormous greed and it's never enough, and they're so, how do you say it, so eaten up from the inside of all this darkness. It's only when love enters that they can heal, and that they will stop this awful, all of these awful things that are going on. So judge the sin and not the sinners, I would say.
Thanks, Ole. Great show. Have a good evening, sir.
You too. Take care.
Good night.
Good night.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Hi, this is Bo.
And this is Rocco.
And the Bo and Rocco Show is here to offer insight into legal and lawful remedies. Our goal is to remain free and help others remain free in an ever-increasing police-like state. With the help of our guests, we try to answer questions such as what went wrong and what can we do about it.
So tune into Revolution Radio at www.freedomslips.com Wednesday nights, 10 to 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to listen to the Bo and Rocco Show.
You don't need to expect us.
We're already here.
Revolution Radio.
Every Tuesday evening on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, we present our goddess spiritual warrior, Kathy Bilski.
I command. I call to the architect of the universe's divine creators and ask for permission to quantum leap the world in all life forms on all planes and dimensions.